Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the April 13 through 19 edition of The Economist. We'll begin with The Leaders, a collection of six articles this week, chosen by Economist editors to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first will be The Sense of an Ending, The Rights and Wrongs of Assisted Dying. Subheading, Britain's Next Great Social Reform is Coming, and Here's How It Should Work. Second, and this is the cover story this week, a $25 trillion hit. Global warming is coming for your home. Who will pay for the damage? Third, four-leafed voters. True swing voters are extraordinarily rare in America. Subheading, we have found some. Fourth, the CAS review. America should follow England's lead on transgender care for kids. Subheading, its approach is neither as harsh as in red states, nor as lax as in blue states. Fifth, war in Gaza, the short-sighted Israeli army. Subheading, force alone cannot bring security. Fifth and finally, what's in names? In praise of Peter Higgs, the subatomic particle named after him became a selling point, and for the man, it was a bit of a pain. Following the reading of those six leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles chosen from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and of course Britain, all as time allows. So, turning now to that first leader's article, we have the title, The Sense of an Ending, The Rights and Wrongs of Assisted Dying. Subheading, Britain's Next Great Social Reform is Coming, Here's How It Should Work. Britain has become a much more liberal country in recent decades. In 1981, only 12% of Britons thought that homosexuality was justifiable, according to the World Values Survey. In 2022, the figure was 66%. Over the same period, the proportion of people who were accepting of divorce rose from 18% to 64%. Where the public has led, politicians have followed. Same-sex marriages were legalized in 2013. No-fault divorces became possible in 2022. That pattern may well be about to repeat itself with assisted dying. Over two-thirds of Britons support changing the law to let someone help in the suicide of a person with a terminal illness. Assisted dying has a good chance of getting on the statute book in the near future. Bills are already in progress on the Isle of Man, in Jersey, and in Scotland. Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, is sympathetic and has promised a free vote among MPs if his party wins the next general election. If The Economist had a vote, it would be unequivocally in favor. The case for assisted dying is at its core one of individual freedom. Britons have the right to marry whom they want. They have the right to roam. Through an obscure medieval law, some even have the right to drive sheep across London Bridge. They should have the right to choose the manner and timing of their death. The more complex question is what form an assisted dying regime should take. That's not just to ensure safeguards against abuses, though it must undoubtedly do that. It's also to make sure that the law is not drawn too tightly. Britain is, in many ways, late to the issue, as are countries like Ireland and France. A bill was presented to the French cabinet this week. Belgium, the Netherlands, Oregon, and Switzerland have had assisted dying laws for decades. 17 jurisdictions have passed laws since we argued in favor of legalization in 2015. Although opponents of assisted dying have deeply held beliefs and raised legitimate concerns, the actual experience of these many jurisdictions strengthens the arguments in its favor. Take concerns about coercion. Critics argue that no regime could ever fully protect the vulnerable from relatives looking to claim an inheritance, or indeed from a state seeking to cut health care costs. Yet the evidence suggests that cases of coercion are extremely rare. The state should do its best to help people live well, whether through social support or palliative care, but if it cannot, those who truly wish to die should not be obliged to suffer. In places where an assisted death remains illegal, only those with money have the option to take matters into their own hands. On average, one Briton a week travels to Switzerland to end their life there. The rights of hypothetically vulnerable patients are taking precedence over the rights of those who are actually in anguish. Some critics say that assisted dying is a, quote, slippery slope, end quote. If this is the fundamental reason for your opposition, you're pretty much conceding the principle that there are indeed instances when it would be right to help someone die. It's the scope that is the problem. In any case, experience suggests that no such slope exists. Although eligibility criteria for an assisted death have expanded in Belgium and the Netherlands, they've never done so in a jurisdiction whose initial laws were restricted to terminally ill adults. Canada's decision to postpone the extension of assisted dying laws to the mentally ill until 2027 showed that it's possible to press pause. True, the numbers of people seeking assisted deaths is increasing. They now make up 4% of all deaths in Canada and 5% in the Netherlands. Yet if those higher figures are an expression of people's desire to make use of a new freedom, as is overwhelmingly likely, they are a reason to pass laws and not to block them. Whether out of conviction or caution, politicians tend to respond to such concerns by writing laws that are based on Oregon's model, which requires a person to be terminally ill with less than 6 months to live to be eligible for an assisted death. This is the approach being followed in Ireland. France's assisted dying bill is also limited to the terminally ill, even though a citizens' assembly convened by President Emmanuel Macron supported a broader law for those suffering unbearably from an incurable illness. The Oregon template is also likely to be the one MPs in Westminster will eventually end up debating if previous bills are a guide. It is too restrictive. Strict time constraints mean that people often die before they can receive the lethal medication, and many people suffer terribly with a disease that's not terminal. Canada's model, which allows someone to determine for themselves whether their suffering is unbearable, is fairer. A person there must be suffering from a serious and incurable medical condition and must wait 90 days to reflect on their decision. Arguments that this broader scope devalues disabled lives are well-meaning but paternalistic. 3/4 of Canadians with disabilities support the existing law. The thorniest issues arise when it's hard to determine whether people are of sound mind. Canada's decision to postpone the extension of assisted dying laws to people with mental health disorders is sensible for this reason. Mental suffering is as real as physical suffering, yet society's understanding of it is still inadequate. Doctors must be able to tell between a considered rational wish to die and a suicidal impulse, a distinction many clinicians feel unable to make. Dementia, which already afflicts 1 in 11 Britons over 65, is also a difficult area. It's possible for someone in the early stages of dementia to make a request in advance for an assisted death, but their wishes when the time comes should prevail. When in doubt, the best rule of thumb is not to proceed. The right balance. There is no guarantee that politicians in Britain will vote in favor of assisted dying, but when they do debate the issue, they should not default to the narrowest definition of what is a basic human right. All adults of sound mind who are enduring unbearable suffering with no prospect of recovery should be able to choose the way they die. And our second Leaders article this week, and this is the cover story this week, is Global Warming is Coming for Your Home. Who will pay for the damage? The master title, a $25 trillion hit. Think about the places vulnerable to climate change, and you might picture rice paddies in Bangladesh or low-lying islands in the Pacific. But another more surprising answer ought to be your own house. About a tenth of the world's residential property by value is under threat from global warming, including many houses that are nowhere near the coast. From tornadoes battering Midwestern American suburbs to tennis ball-sized hailstones smashing the roofs of Italian villas, the severe weather brought about by greenhouse gas emissions is shaking the foundations of the world's most important asset class. The potential costs stem from policies designed to reduce the emissions of houses, as well as from climate-related damage. They are enormous. By one estimate, climate change and the fight against it could wipe out 9% of the value of the world's housing by 2050, which amounts to $25 trillion, not much less than America's annual GDP. It's a huge bill hanging over people's lives in the global financial system, and it looks destined to trigger an almighty fight over who should pay up. Homeowners are one candidate, but if you look at property markets today, they don't seem to be bearing the costs. House prices show little sign of adjusting to climate risk. In Miami, the subject of much worrying about rising sea levels, they have increased by 4/5 this decade, much more than the American average. Moreover, because the impact of climate change is still uncertain, many owners may not have known how much of a risk they were taking when they bought their homes. Yet, if taxpayers cough up instead, they will bail out well-heeled owners and blunt helpful incentives to adapt to the looming threat. Apportioning the costs will be hard for governments, not least because they know voters care so much about the value of their homes. The bill has three parts: paying for repairs, investing in protection, and modifying houses to limit climate change. Insurers usually bear the costs of repairs after a storm destroys a roof or fire could gut a property. As the climate worsens and natural disasters become more frequent, home insurance is therefore getting more expensive. In places, it could become so dear as to cause house prices to fall. Some experts warn of a climate insurance bubble affecting a third of American homes. Governments must either tolerate the losses that imposes on homeowners or underwrite the risks themselves, as already happens in parts of wildfire-prone California and hurricane-prone Florida. The combined exposure of state-backed insurers of last resort in these two states has exploded from $160 billion in 2017 to $633 billion. Local politicians want to pass on the risk to the federal government, which in effect runs flood insurance today. Physical damage might be forestalled by investing in protection in properties themselves or in infrastructure. Keeping houses habitable may call for air conditioning. Few Indian homes have it, even though the country is suffering worsening heat waves. In the Netherlands, a system of dikes, ditches, and pumps keeps the country dry. Tokyo has barriers to hold back floodwaters. Funding this investment is the second challenge. Should homeowners who had no idea they were at risk to have to pay for, say, concrete underpinning for a subsiding house? Or is it right to protect them from such unexpected and unevenly distributed costs? Densely populated coastal cities, which are most in need of protection from floods, are often the crown jewels of their country's economies and societies. Just think of London, New York, or Shanghai. The last question is how to pay for domestic modifications that prevent further climate change. Houses account for 18% of global energy-related emissions. Many are likely to need heat pumps, which work best with underfloor heating, or bigger radiators and thick insulation. Unfortunately, retrofitting homes is expensive. Asking homeowners to pay up can lead to a backlash. Last year, Germany's ruling coalition tried to ban gas boilers, only to change course when voters objected to the cost. Italy followed an alternative approach by offering extraordinarily generous and badly designed handouts to households who renovate. It has spent a staggering 219 billion euro on its Superbonus scheme. The full impact of climate change is still some way off, but the sooner policymakers can resolve these questions, the better. The evidence shows that house prices react to these risks only after disaster has struck, when it is too late for preventative investments. Inertia is therefore likely to lead to nasty surprises. Housing is too important an asset to be mispriced across the economy not least because it's so vital to the financial system. Governments will have to do their job. Until the 18th century, much of the Netherlands followed the principle that only nearby communities would maintain dikes, and the system was plagued by underinvestment and needless flooding as a result. Governments alone can solve such collective action problems by building infrastructure, and must do so, especially around high productivity cities. Owners will need inducements to spend big sums retrofitting their homes to pollute less, which benefits everyone. Why het water duurt? At the same time, however, policymakers must be careful not to subsidize folly by offering large implicit guarantees and explicit state-backed insurance schemes. These not only pose an unacceptable risk to taxpayers, they also weaken the incentive for people to invest in making their properties more resilient. And by suppressing insurance premiums, they do nothing to discourage people from moving to areas already known to be high risk today. The omens are not good, even though the stakes are so high. For decades, governments have failed to disincentivize building on floodplains. The $25 trillion bill will pose problems around the world, but doing nothing today will only make tomorrow more painful. For both governments and homeowners, the worst response to the housing conundrum would be to ignore it. And our third Leaders article this week is titled Four-Leafed Voters. True swing voters are extraordinarily rare in America. Subheading, we have found some. The biggest question in American politics today is why Joe Biden's support is so soft. Although there are plenty of theories, ranging from Mr. Biden's age to petrol prices to the withdrawal from Afghanistan, it's hard to be confident about an answer. A standard poll of the type quoted in news reports may be based on a sample of 1,000 people. A poll that asks questions of voters in a swing state might have, or might be half that number. These yield useful information, no doubt, but if you want to look within these polls at what, say, Hispanic Protestants think of President Biden, the numbers are too small to draw conclusions. We've found a way around this problem. Over the past year, YouGov has posed questions to a total of 49,000 Americans of voting age. If you pool their answers, as we have this week, you can discover what's really going on. Because most American voters are partisan and opinions about the two candidates are so calcified, very few people who voted for Joe Biden in 2020 will vote for Donald Trump in November, or vice versa. In a tight election, swing voters have double value because they subtract from one side and add to the other. Finding them, though, is like hunting for four-leafed clovers. Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump are close to tied in national polls. Mr. Trump is doing better than that in swing states. Overall, compared with 2020, there's been a shift of 2 percentage points in Mr. Trump's favor. This change has two sources. The first is made up of people who voted for Mr. Biden in 2020 and now say they're either undecided, supporting a third party, or planning not to vote. This is a reminder that if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. makes it onto the ballot in swing states, he could tip the election. Mr. Kennedy, whom we profile this week, refuses to be drawn on whether Mr. Biden or Mr. Trump would be worse for America and says his internal polling shows him mainly attracting independent voters rather than from one particular candidate. Other polls, however, suggest that higher third-party support has done more harm to Mr. Biden. The second source of weakness for Mr. Biden is genuine swing voters who have deserted him for Mr. Trump. Among our 49,000, some 465 voted for Mr. Trump last time and say they'll now back Mr. Biden. There are 632 Biden to Trump voters. Many people who recall the chaos of Mr. Trump's presidency and its riotous conclusion have seen recent jobs data will be wondering what on earth these folks are thinking. Our mega sample has drawn some answers on that too. Swing voters do not view this year's election as Republicans would like them to. Immigration is not the most important issue for them, nor do they view it as Democrats wish. Their most important issue is not the defense of democracy, climate policy, or abortion. It is inflation, which remains sticky, followed by the economy. Politics is less central to the lives of swing voters than it is to news hounds and committed partisans. They may not know much about Mr. Biden's position on natural gas or North Korea, but they do know that eggs are expensive and driving to work costs too much. The other, perhaps more surprising, finding is that these swing voters are who they are. Those most likely to have swung from Mr. Biden to Mr. Trump are non-white parents of school-age children. That may reflect abiding fury at overlong school lockdowns during the pandemic. It also reflects a notable trend that race and voting are becoming unstuck. In the short term, this is troubling because it makes Mr. Trump's return to the White House more likely. Looking further in the future, however, it promises to be a blessing. A multiracial democracy in which everyone votes according to their race is a nightmarish prospect. Politics should be a competition between ideas rather than identities, and America is swinging in that direction. And our fourth leader's article is titled The Cass Review, C-A-S-S. Main title, America Should Follow England's Lead on Transgender Care for Kids. And the subtitle, Its Approach is Neither as Harsh as in Red States nor as Lax in Blue States. Calm discussions of transgender medicine are rare. Quote, there are few other areas of health care where professionals are so afraid to openly discuss their views, end quote. So argues Hilary Cass, a British doctor. On April 9th, she published a 388-page report commissioned by England's National Health Service, assessing the evidence for and against treatments for children who identify as transgender. Its conclusions will reverberate on both sides of the Atlantic, where the standards of care differ wildly. The treatments at issue include puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and, rarely, surgery. Puberty blockers are drugs that delay the onset of puberty. Cross-sex hormones stimulate the development of opposite-sex characteristics. Estrogen, which causes males to grow larger breasts. Testosterone gives females bigger muscles and deeper voices, among other things. There's not a reliable evidence base to show that the benefits of offering such treatments to children outweigh the harms, says the Cass Review. Many studies have been published, but they're often of poor quality. Some draw conclusions from tiny samples. Some lack control groups so that outcomes for patients receiving treatment are not compared with outcomes for those who do not. Far too little effort has been made to observe long-term effects. Some clinics even resisted attempts to gather such data. Quote, it is unusual for us to give a potentially life-changing treatment to young people and not know what happens to them in adulthood, end quote. So says Dr. Cass when speaking to the BBC. In the rich world, approaches to transgender care for children now fall into three broad categories, laissez-faire, draconian, and cautious. The laissez-faire approach, common in blue states in America, argues that if children identify as the opposite gender and desperately want to adjust their bodies to align with that feeling, they should be allowed to do so. If denied such, quote, gender-affirming care, end quote, their lives will be blighted and they may consider ending them, proponents say. Some activists add, in forceful language, that only transphobes could possibly object. The American Academy of Pediatrics, a national body, supports the provision of puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones to minors while evaluating new evidence. The draconian approach is such that treatments should simply be banned. This is common in red American states where some politicians stir up antipathy towards transgender people in order to win votes. Some states combine bans on treatment with harsh penalties for doctors who offer it. Florida threatens them with 5 years in prison. Idaho, 10. Texas has tried to investigate whether parents who seek such care for their children are fit to be parents, though this is now tied up in court. In all, 22 American states have outlawed or restricted transgender care for adolescents, most of them recently. The cautious approach, which informs policy in Denmark, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and now England, stresses that more evidence is needed. No one is sure why the number of children who identify as transgender has exploded in the past decade. Before giving them drugs which can make them permanently sterile and unable to experience an orgasm, medics should explore other interventions. Many trans-identifying children are on the autism spectrum. Many suffer from depression and should be offered counseling. Many eventually desist, sometimes realizing they're gay, not trans. Health providers should not rush into invasive treatments, even if the child demands them. Thus, the NHS in England now offers puberty blockers only as part of a clinical trial. Cross-sex hormones should be provided only to children over 16, and with extreme caution, says the CAS review. As The Economist has argued before, the cautious approach is the wisest. Transgender people should always be treated with respect and kindness, and adults should be free to make their own decisions about their bodies. But as Dr. Cass concludes, it's essential to guard against, quote, the creep of unproven approaches into clinical practice, end quote. This may be hard in an area that has become so politically contentious. It may also be harder in health systems where private doctors are paid for each intervention and thus have an incentive to give patients what they ask for. Nonetheless, it's the responsibility of medical authorities to offer treatments based on solid evidence. And our fifth leader's article is titled, The Short-Sighted Israeli Army. Force alone cannot bring security. These two titles come under the heading War in Gaza. The story of the Israel Defense Forces is the story of Israel itself. From the creation of the state in 1948, the IDF has repeatedly fought and won wars with Arab countries that were bent on destroying it. Israelis see their army as the best of themselves, tough, shrewd, and innovative. Despite the IDF's terrible failure to predict or prevent the incursion from Gaza on October 7, 2023, many Israelis think their army has gone on to have a good war. A former Israeli general and national security advisor this week said that Operation Swords of Iron would come to be viewed as an exemplar of how to conduct urban combat. As our reporting makes clear, the reality in Gaza is different. The campaign against Hamas is justified, but it has been marred by the IDF's over-reliance on technology and lack of strategic thinking. Most of all, the army has suffered from the self-serving rivalries and cramped vision of Israel's political leaders. As so often, Palestinians have paid the price. In this, too, the story of the IDF is the story of Israel. Two areas where the IDF has fallen short are its responsibilities as an occupying power and its duty to minimize civilian deaths. Some 1.7 million people have been displaced. Many lack adequate food, water, or medicine. For months, a few hundred lorry loads of food have been getting into Gaza, far below the 500 or so a day that is the minimum needed. Outraged, some countries have resorted to dangerous, costly airdrops. Israel insists it has done all that humanitarian law demands, but persistent and seemingly arbitrary blockages of aid contradict that. So do Israel's own belated efforts in recent days, under great pressure from America, its main ally, to prevent a looming famine. IDF officers have blamed politicians for shortages, but at the very least, they should have foreseen how these would come to define their operations. The civilian death toll is also of grave concern to many people. Tens of thousands of deaths and injuries and the destruction of so much of Gaza could never be justified. Israeli officials retort that war is harsh and the ratio of civilian deaths to combatants is about 2-to-1, a figure that roughly matches independent studies and is similar to Iraq when an American-led coalition struck its Islamic State in Mosul in 2016 and 17. Comparisons are hard and figures are inexact, but even if that's true, many armies would find Israel's rules of engagement disproportionate and hence illegal. The IDF is reported to have set the threshold of civilian deaths in justifying decisions to strike a junior Hamas fighter at 20-to-1 and a senior leader at 100-to-1. For Saddam Hussein, Iraq's dictator, America set a threshold of 30-1. The IDF may also have been indiscriminate, that would be illegal too. A report from Inside Israel claims that early in the war, when the army was determined to take vengeance for October 7th, it assembled target lists using artificial intelligence, and that the pressure to move ahead was so great that humans gave the system only cursory oversight. Israeli officials vehemently deny this, but it would not be the first time in war that, without a clear sense of what counts as victory, kill rates become the measure of progress. Amid these excesses, the IDF risks falling short in its chief aim of destroying Hamas. After 6 months, the terrorist group's most senior leaders remain alive, and over 100 hostages are still in captivity. The IDF talks of attacking 4 remaining Hamas battalions in Rafah, in the south of Gaza, but that is a formula for disaster. About 1.5 million people are sheltering near Rafah, and Israel has yet to produce a plan for protecting them. Israel appears to have no strategy for preventing Hamas, or something like it, from rising from the rubble. Without it, it will be subject to the devastating mathematics of insurgency, in which operations designed to reduce the number of terrorists attract more than enough recruits to replace them. It's not too late to change course, yet Israelis politicians, former IDF officers among them, want bombs and bullets to substitute for a political vision of the war's end. Without a plan for peace, Israel will end up as an occupier or repeatedly striking Gaza. Either way, it will pay a high price militarily, economically, and diplomatically. The IDF depends on outside countries, especially America and Germany, to supply vital weapons. If Western voters rejected the idea of supporting an unending conflict, their politicians would eventually follow. Our proposal for peace is built on a temporary ceasefire in exchange for a hostage release. That would lead to a regional deal involving Arab money and possibly security. Just now, neither Israel nor Hamas is interested. That makes sense for Hamas, which thrives on conflict and Palestinian suffering. For Israel and its citizens, army, it makes no sense at all. And just past the halfway mark in today's broadcast, we remind you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading today from the April 13 through 19 edition of The Economist. And moving to our sixth and final leaders article, we have the title, What's in a Name, in praise of Peter Higgs, H-I-G-G-S. The subheading, the particle named after him became a selling point. For the man, it was a bit of a pain. If it had been up to Peter Higgs, the world would have taken no heed of his death on April 8th, nor for that matter the 94 years of life which preceded it. He valued the respect of his colleagues and treasured his occasional bright ideas about the way the universe worked. The fact that one of those bright ideas ended up boiled down into an object bearing his name, which became the subject of a world-encompassing multi-billion dollar quest, was a source of some exasperation. The Higgs boson's discovery, he said, ruined my life. That's a quote. Dr. Higgs' best-knowing bright idea was arcane but crucial. There are two types of fundamental particles, fermions and bosons. The symmetrical nature of the equations which describe bosons implies they should be massless. By the 1950s, though, it seemed that some bosons did have mass. Some fundamental symmetries were in practice broken. Untangling the mathematics of broken symmetries became a preoccupation of particle physicists. Dr. Higgs' contribution, made over a few weeks in the summer of 1964, was a mathematical description of a new boson that could give mass to bosons in need of it. In 1983, a daring modification of a particle accelerator at CERN, C-E-R-N, the European Physics Lab near Geneva, produced direct evidence of 3 massive bosons, 2 W's and a Z, predicted by the theory which unified electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. This boson bonanza left some American physicists miffed. They told the government which funded them that America was losing an important race. The proposed comeback was the Superconducting Super Collider, or SSC, a particle accelerator of extraordinary power that would be 87 kilometers in circumference. The Higgs boson was a key part of the pitch. The particle's existence was predicted by theory, but as has been the case with the W's and Z's, its discovery was impossible without a powerful enough machine. The SSC would be that machine. Journalists grasped that if there was a Higgs particle, there must also be a Higgs. 24 years after writing his original paper, Dr. Higgs found himself doing the first interview. Leon Lederman, a champion of the SSC, to whom press availability was a joy, not a chore, dubbed Higgs the God Particle, thereby increasing the hype and sales of his thus-titled book. In 1993, Congress canceled the SSC, and its European rival, CERN's LHC, carried on. Physicists thought that the Higgs was a known unknown, that's a quote, which their machine, though smaller, still stood a good chance of producing, and it was central to the way it was sold to politicians and the public. The LHC delivered the goods in 2012, and the Nobel Prize Committee followed suit the next year. Dr. Higgs grinned sometimes and bore the attention. It was not just that the particle carried its name. Their story was so beguiling. The humble theorist in his garret, actually a third-floor flat in Edinburgh's Newtown, who goes unheralded for decades, but whose ideas eventually change the world, how's that for the untrammeled power of the singular mind? But it was never really true. Dr. Higgs, as he always made clear, was one of many scientists coming up with similar ideas at a time when soundbite-friendly baubles to win funding for city-sized accelerators was still unthinkable. It might have been best had it stayed so. What scientists actually want from big science rarely boils down to a single thing. They want the means with which to explore widely. The public wants to know that new discoveries are being made, casting scientific projects as quests for some preordained grail, dread word, be it a single boson or a single human genome, may make the story simple, but it always underplays the true ambition and delight of creating tools that make new types of science possible. And it makes the chance of disappointment even greater. More than a decade after its discovery, it is hard to argue that finding the Higgs particle has changed the world, or for that matter, physics, all that much. It is worth remembering, as Dr. Higgs always knew, that what really matters is the process, not the prize. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin, as usual, with an article on the United States. This one is titled Conservatives on Campus: A Challenge to Leftist Bias Moves into America's Public Universities. Subheading: Florida Leads a Push Against Prevailing Progressivism. In 1951, a 25-year-old Yale graduate published a 240-page polemic inveighing against his alma mater's left-leaning bias. The book launched the career of William F. Buckley, the most influential conservative intellectual of the post-war era. Although Buckley managed to reshape the Republican Party, his war against academia proved less successful. Conservatives still haven't given up on changing the academy. The most robust reform momentum is now building at public university systems. In Florida, in particular, a trio of Yale alumni have ambitious plans to change the future of higher education. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida who graduated from Yale in 2001, likes to say that his state is, quote, where the woke goes to die, end quote. In universities, he put in place a 10-year review process which critics say weakened academic freedom, and he has used his appointment powers to influence institutions. At New College of Florida, a public liberal arts college that had been a bastion of progressivism, he appointed new trustees who fired the president and replaced him with a former Republican lawmaker. Scores of faculty and students left. New College, which had fewer than 700 students in the autumn of 2022, has drawn national attention. Yet much more consequential reforms are underway at the University of Florida, or UF, the state's flagship university and home to some 60,000 students. It ranks as one of the top public universities in America, and it also offers an increasingly attractive bargain. Undergraduate tuition and fees are only $6,380 this academic year for in-state students. Ben Sasse, a former Republican senator who became UF's president in February 2023, says that producing graduates who can thrive in a disruptive jobs market is at the heart of his mission. He still believes a fundamental part of this ought to be learning about the liberal arts, but, says Mr. Sasse, who earned a doctorate in history at Yale, humanities faculties at most universities are not, quote, sure what their purpose is right now, end quote. A core curriculum, he says, is, quote, incredibly important for an educated citizenry, but you have to be making a case that you're speaking to things that are big and broad and meaningful and enduring, end quote. He argues that this isn't a right-wing project, but a classically liberal one, and at the heart of it is UF's new Hamilton Center. Authorized by the Florida legislature in 2022, the center is a $30 million wager on the appeal of Western civilization. Mr. Sasse has said that he intends Hamilton to become UF's 17th college, joining existing ones such as those for business, engineering, law, medicine, and pharmacy. Next year, it will begin offering two majors, philosophy, politics, economics, and law, and great books and ideas. Will Inboden, Hamilton's director, wants UF to have America's top program in Western civilization. The center already employs a dozen faculty members in a cramped space on UF's sprawling campus, dominated by the Florida Gators football stadium. It is hiring dozens more and eventually will move to its own building. Mr. Inboden says part of the strategy is to seek out faculty in fields neglected by modern humanities departments, such as military and diplomatic history. He also favors public-facing academics. Sunshine Statement. Mr. Inboden and Mr. Sasse, who attended graduate school at Yale together, both served in the administration of George W. Bush. But Mr. Inboden argues the Hamilton Center is a pre-political project. Students are pretty leery of being indoctrinated, he said. The answer to progressive indoctrination on campuses is not conservative counter-indoctrination. Jill Ingram, Hamilton's director of undergraduate students, echoes a desire to avoid a reputation of being a politicized entity. We're interested in giving students the tools and the practice to think for themselves, but also to bring back an appreciation for the texts and the ideas that were involved in the founding of America, end quote. The center has received a mixed reception on campus. One student recalls telling an advisor she plans to apply for a fellowship through the center. Quote, she was like, don't apply for that. It's a bunch of right-wing stormtroopers, end quote. Yet many who take classes from Hamilton faculty aren't even aware the center exists as its own entity. Students associated with it come from a variety of political backgrounds. Florida is not alone. Other states with new schools focusing on civic thought include Arizona, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. A Republican state legislature funded Arizona State University's School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership. When a Democrat, Katie Hobbs, became governor in 2023, it seems its days might have been numbered. Ms. Hobbs labeled the school, quote, libertarian, end quote, and proposed reallocating the funding. After some debate, however, Democrats backed down. Places like the Hamilton Center will face two related challenges. Finding faculty for a growing number of institutions could become harder in the years ahead. Harder still will be to avoid becoming conservative ghettos within their university. Ray Rodriguez, chancellor of the State University System of Florida, says the goal is to offer better general education courses to all. He and his colleagues also aspire to create scholars who will influence new generations. Quote, if at the end of the day what we're doing is merely trading conservative scholars from one institution to another, then we will have failed. End quote. And turning next to the section on Asia, We have an article titled Indo-Pacific Statecraft. America's Asian allies are trying to Trump-proof their policies. Subheading here, Kishida Fumio meets Joe Biden in Washington, D.C. to shore up deterrence. The Prime Minister of Japan, Kishida Fumio, is keeping a laser-like eye on conflicts around the world and the implications for his country's security. If Russia is allowed to prevail in Ukraine, it will send the wrong signal to Asia, Mr. Kishida told The Economist and other reporters in a wood-paneled room at the Akante, the Prime Minister's office, on April 5th. The desire to strengthen Japan's security alliance explains why he went to the White House on April 10th for a state dinner with Joe Biden, America's president. The two leaders announced a host of measures to deepen defense and security cooperation between their countries. Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos, president of the Philippines, another ally, was due to join Mr. Biden and Mr. Kishida the following day. American officials tout the gatherings as evidence that its Asian alliances are evolving. What they do not say, but is implied, is that they are also trying to protect the relationship from damage Donald Trump could do if he wins again. America's alliances in Asia have helped keep the peace in the region for decades. In contrast to Europe, where NATO binds dozens of nations into a mutual defense pact, America has discrete bilateral treaties with Japan, South Korea, Australia, the Philippines, and Thailand in a hub-and-spokes system. Under Mr. Biden, America has sought to foster links between the spokes in the hope of countering China's rise. America's allies have largely embraced the effort, especially Japan. Working together with like-minded countries on security issues will lead to the establishment of a multi-layered network, and by expanding that, we can improve deterrence, so says Mr. Kishida. Hewing closely to prepared notes, he appeared solemn in his interview as he spoke of his belief that the world is at a historic turning point and faces a very complex and challenging security environment. What lies behind such talk of a network is a collection of smaller groupings that collaborate on security. America, Japan, and South Korea now hold regular high-level meetings in a trilateral format. So too do America, Japan, and the Philippines. AUKUS, a defense pact signed in 2021, brings together America, Australia, and Britain. On April 8th, the three countries' defense ministers announced they are considering cooperation with Japan through AUKUS. The result is greater integration between armed forces across the region. In recent years, joint exercises have expanded to include a wider range of partners. America, Japan, Australia, and the Philippines trained together for the first time in the South China Sea on April 7th amid continuing Chinese provocations there. Intelligence sharing is expanding too. America, Japan, and South Korea now share data in real time when North Korea launches missiles, which is happening more often. Mr. Biden and Mr. Kishida announced a new air defense initiative between America, Australia, and Japan. Talk of a more multilateral approach to Asian security long predates Mr. Biden. In the early 1950s, America mooted a NATO-esque Pacific Pact, but encountered resistance both from Japan, which wanted to focus on its post-war recovery, and from Japan's neighbors, which harbored deep concerns about its rearmament. The current context is different. Many in Asia now worry more about Chinese aggression. Under Abe Shinzo, Japan's prime minister from 2012 to 2020, the country loosened its constitutional restrictions on the use of force and expanded defense spending. Mr. Kishida has accelerated that approach. Japan's defense budget grew by 50% between 2022 and this year. The country aims to nearly double spending on defense activities to 2% of GDP by 2027, up from 1.2% in 2022. Defensive postures. Yet for all those developments, the only formal treaties that exist are still those each country has with America itself. the distinctions meaningful. As the war in Ukraine shows, there's a stark difference between the kind of support given to treaty allies and to a wider category of partners. Although Taiwan is the most dangerous regional flashpoint, it has no guarantees of security assistance. It has small training exchanges with America's forces, but no joint exercises with any country in the region. America has promised to help Taiwan defend itself, but has no legal obligation to fight on Taiwan's behalf. There are limits to how deep the ties between America's allies in Asia can become. There's not going to be an Asian NATO, says one official from an allied nation. Domestic political realities create barriers. In Japan, for example, a pacifist constitution still makes it difficult to enter into new treaty alliances with mutual defense requirements. Its pact with America requires America to come to its defense, but not the other way around. And Japan looks unlikely to formally join AUKUS anytime soon. Shortly after the defense minister's statement on April 8th, Anthony Albanese, Australia's prime minister, clarified there were no plans to add new members to the pact. Mr. Kishida reiterated this on April 10th. Australia worries about Japan's ability to protect sensitive information and technology. Unlike the current members of AUKUS, Japan does not belong to the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Pact. Japan is wary of provoking China, its biggest trade partner. Another problem is that some allies, such as Thailand, are glaringly absent from the picture. The current governments of South Korea and the Philippines are largely of like minds with those of America, Australia, and Japan. But under different leaders, they could, again, diverge. The biggest potential problem, however, surrounds American leadership. Mr. Trump's first term shook allies' confidence in America's reliability. While Mr. Biden has done much to repair the security relationships, he has continued his predecessor's protectionist anti-trade ways, much to his Asian allies' dismay, as with his decision to oppose the takeover of U.S. Steel, an American firm, by Nippon Steel, a Japanese one. America's deep internal divisions raise questions about its ability to maintain its global obligations in the long run. It all depends on America, on whether they want to continue playing that role, says a senior official from another ally. If Mr. Trump is reelected, those worries would become more acute. In Japan, the fears are captured in the phrase Moshitora, an abbreviation that means, what if Trump? Or its more fretful variants, Hobotora, meaning probably Trump, and Mutora, already Trump. Some are optimistic that even if Mr. Trump returns, America's allies in Asia will face fewer problems than those in Europe. They point to the fact that America First types see China as a key adversary. There will be continuity and how the Biden and Trump administrations see the situation in the Indo-Pacific. Alexander Gray, who served on Mr. Trump's National Security Council, told a recent conference in Tokyo. Even so, America's allies are bracing themselves. Diplomats are scrambling to make inroads with Mr. Trump's current crop of advisors. Politicians are working to reinforce relationships on Capitol Hill in state governments. Mr. Kishida was due to address a joint session of Congress on April 11th and visit a Toyota factory in North Carolina on April 12th to highlight Japanese investment into America. Officials in Asia have several sets of fears. For one thing, if Mr. Trump abandons Ukraine, it matters to the Indo-Pacific, too. Newer multilateral initiatives in Asia may wither under Mr. Trump. In Australia, some skeptics worry that Mr. Trump would refuse to sell submarines to Australia on the basis that America is not producing enough for its own needs, which could undermine AUKUS. Trade tensions will rise alongside American tariffs. Mr. Trump will probably put pressure on allies to spend even more on defense than they already do. In particular, Mr. Trump may demand more of Taiwan, which raised its defense spending from 1.8% of GDP in 2016 to 2.5% in 2024, but has yet to reach a target of 3%. At the same time, he may also be less careful about keeping America's military support for Taiwan quiet, raising the chances of a confrontation over the island. Exit America. Among America's formal allies in Asia, South Korea probably faces the most danger. During his previous term, Mr. Trump halted large-scale military exercises as a gesture of good faith during negotiations with Kim Jong-un, North Korea's leader. Former advisors say he was fixated on drawing down America's 28,500 troops on the peninsula. Christopher Miller, a former acting Secretary of Defense, recently spoke about reducing America's troop levels in an interview with a Korean newspaper. That might prompt South Korea to pursue its own nuclear deterrent, a step that over 70% of the public already supports. While the chances of Mr. Trump retreating from Asia may be lower than the chances of him abandoning Europe, allies in Asia would be in a weaker position if he did. Even if America left NATO, the other 31 members could remain, including France and Britain, which have nuclear arsenals themselves. Asian allies would be on their own and face nuclear-backed threats from China and North Korea. The combined GDP of the remaining NATO members is equivalent to 10 times that of Russia. The combined GDP of America's Asian allies is roughly half the size of China's. Quote, they cannot balance Chinese power without America in the mix, end quote. So says Richard Samuels of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In short, spokes without a hub still cannot get very far. And in the short time remaining, we have this business item. Intel unveiled its Gaudi 3 chip for AI, which it claims is faster and more power efficient than NVIDIA's H100. It tested the chip on two open-source large language models, Llama, which is run by Meta, and Falcon, a project backed by Abu Dhabi. Intel announced their plan to create, with other tech companies, an open platform for enterprise AA that will accelerate deployment of secure generative AI systems. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the April 13 through 19 edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.